You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 308. This is Features Editor John Gentile, and I'm here with Managing Editor Adam White and News Editor Ricky Frankel. No opening this week because it's a sad week. It's a tragic week here at Punk News, in the Philadelphia punk scene and the punk scene in general. And so we're not going to sugarcoat it. It's just a bad, bad week. As you probably know, Eric Peterson of Mischief Brew passed away. You'll be hearing this on Sunday, so it would have been about 10 days prior to you hearing this. If you don't know, Eric Peterson was a wonderful musician. He was in a band called Mischief Brew. He was also in a band called Kettle Rebellion and the Orphans, and they were sort of a fixture of the Philadelphia punk scene. And they were actually one of the first, if not the first, bands to blend folk and punk, but they weren't really folk punk. They were more what I would say anarcho-punk and folk, if that makes any sense. They didn't necessarily always blend those two sides together. And Eric will always be a special figure to me because he's actually the very first person I ever interviewed way back in 2007. I was sent to interview him for Ridgivation magazine, which is one of these free magazines they give out in they used to get out in Philadelphia. It doesn't exist anymore. And so I went there. I interviewed him at this place called Lava Space, which is kind of an anarcho book collective kind of space. And it was probably that might be the first true punks place I ever went to. And I interviewed Eric, and he was a super friendly, super cool, super insightful guy. And he gave me a bunch of his CDs. And I wasn't even a fan of the music. And much like my favorite bands, like the Melvins, like maybe Frank Zappa, like Gwar, I didn't necessarily like it at first, but I kept listening to it. And the more and more I listened to it, the more and more I got it until finally it clicked. And I realized, and this is still true to me today, that Mischief Brew is one of the greatest bands, punk rock or not, to ever exist. If you don't know about them, that's fine. They've got three main albums, and really to understand the band, and you can listen to all this on Bandcamp. I think it's mischiefbrew.bandcamp.com. Listen to the first album. That one's called Smash the Windows, and that's kind of like the classic Mischief Brew sound, in that it's anarcho-punk mixed with folk. And the melody and the musicianship and the style and lyrics are just so different. A lot of people try to copy them, but no one really did what they did. The second album, which might be my favorite, is called The Stone Operation, which is almost a straight anarcho-punk album with some heavy Crass and Rudimentary Peni influences. That's one of the greatest punk rock albums ever recorded. And the third one, which is almost as good, which I love, it's the most melancholy one. It's the new one from last year out on Alternative Tentacles. It's called This Is Not For Children, and it's almost like a New Model Army or even a Flux record, and that it's a very clean, propulsive sound. It would be enough to say that Eric was an amazing artist. He really was. Before he was in Mischief Brew, he was in the Orphans, which was kind of a skate punk sort of band, and Kettle Rebellion, which was proto-Mischief Brew. And the way he would combine lyrics and kind of combine medieval imagery with contemporary imagery with a really rocking, swinging sound, even though it was folk music, it never seemed to be the weird, I guess you would say, pantomime of folk music that you see in a lot of the punk scene. It seems so genuine. But even though that's enough on its own, Eric really was one of the nicest people in music I ever met. There was not a single person that I know that would say anything bad about him, and that's rare. I mean, people say bad about anything, anybody. And Eric was a genuinely, truly gentle soul who really did seem to live by the golden rule. And it's quite sad, and I guess quite tragically, as these things happen, is Mischief Brew was a smaller to smaller medium sized band. They weren't an unknown band, but they weren't as big as Against Me or Bomb the Music Industry or any of that. However, maybe they really were, because in the wake of the passing of Eric, it's just insane how much this is being spread out on different news channels, how much people are reacting to it. So you see this a lot, and it's quite tragic that after someone passes away, they could have seen how big and how profound the impact they had on so, so many people. And I think, you know, even though certain bands are big, or I'm not dissing the Hold Steady. The Hold Steady are big, but I wonder if the Hold Steady really were, you know, how impactful, how much they formed to shape people's lives. It's quite clear that Mischief Brew really did shape people's lives. And a couple of things that we should mention is one thing that I always respected the band for is that all their shirts were always printed in USA, which I really, because Eric was really big on unions and you know, fair labor and that kind of a thing. So a lot of bands talk the talk, but Mischief Brew really walked the walk. Eric's wife, Denise, who is pretty much or is as much of part of Mischief Brew as the three band members, Eric Peterson, Chris Peterson, his brother, and Sean Sinclair, the bassist. She and Eric would run Fistola Records. Fistola Records is the label that put out the majority of Mischief Brew stuff. So most Mischief Brew stuff is self-released, not all of it, but most of it. And she's going to continue to run Fistola Records. And this would be against my instinct, but I know this is the case, is that now is a very good time for you to order Mischief Brew items or go to the Mischief Brew Bandcamp and download or buy some tracks there. And my instinct would be to say, well, that's ghoulish. Like, you don't want to act like you're, you know, profiting off somebody's death. But I do know, to quite directly, that people keeping Mischief Brew, keeping Eric in their thoughts, keeping, you know, appreciating and enjoying the music is very important to Denise. And I know that means a lot to her. So if you're going to get Mischief Brew stuff, you should definitely check them out. Even if you don't know anything about them, you should check them out. But now's a great time to go download some tracks or buy some stuff. And I mean, I'll say this because other people won't, is you can buy their stuff at fistolarecords.bigcartel.com. They've got a really great reissue of this first record, Smash the Windows. They've got the Kettle Rebellion LP, which is great. And also, a lot of things are on sale for some reason. Fistola Records put out a Wignall Nunchucka CD-EP, and it's only $1. And if anybody out there is a World Inferno fan, you should buy that because it's got a rare Jack Terrycloth track on it called Captain Sensible Calling. And nobody seems to know about this, but it's a fantastic Jack Terrycloth vocal on track 4. But more importantly, Mischief Brew stuff's for sale. You should go out there and buy it. You will not be sorry. It's some of the greatest music ever recorded. And another thing is we're going to be doing a Mischief Brew radio special at Punk News, where you'll be able to write in and ask us to play a song and say what Mischief Brew meant to you, that kind of a thing. You can email me at johng@podcast.punknews.org. An article about that will probably be posted by the time you hear this. It's a sad day, and we're not going to try to say, oh, well, you know, now let's move on. I find myself wondering, and Adam, I'll just briefly ask your opinion on this, is, What I'm thinking about right now is, I mean, when Dave Brocky passed away, that was an entirely different situation. And I got to mention this too. A lot of rumors out there about how Eric passed away. A lot of websites, particularly one website, are saying some really not nice things. And a lot of people are saying, "Oh, I know intimately. This is, you know, I know directly that this is what happened." People don't know, and almost everything I read out there is completely unfounded. So what you read on the internet, don't believe it because it's not true. I know it's not true. So don't listen to any of that. And if you see somebody on a chat board say, oh, I know what happened, X, Y, Z, they're probably just bullshitting or they don't know or they heard it from somebody, because I know I've seen a lot of conflicting things. Almost all of it is not true. But getting back to the point is, when Dave Brocky passed away, which was a different situation of GWAR, I mean, Dave Brocky was, well, that's a different story, completely different. But I said, well, as a fan, what should I do? And for the, you know, 18 months after Dave Brocky passed away, I kind of made it a point to really play a lot of GWAR music on the Punk News podcast and really talk about GWAR, you know, to keep that art alive. And to my credit, not to pat my, you know, we interviewed GWAR a bunch of times before Dave Brocky passed away, and we did a lot of Mischief Brew, you know, articles before Eric passed away, which underscores the point that you need to appreciate people while they're alive. And you need to tell artists that you think they're great while they're around. Don't be too cool for school. Don't wait till somebody passes away and say, oh, they were so great. Tell people while they're alive. That's when it counts. That's when it matters. But my question is this, is I was certainly good friends with Eric, but I wasn't like best friends with Eric. You know, it's not like we hung out every week. You know, it's not like we emailed each other every day or called each other. Nothing like that. Although I knew Eric and I saw him on a regular basis. The question that I have, and Adam, you can just respond to this briefly if you want, is how much should I guess, promote or comment or, you know, bring up Mischief Brew? my concern is if I do it too much, people might think that I'm self-aggrandizing, or, you know, maybe it's not my place to be the standard bearer for Mischief Brew. Maybe somebody closer to Eric or the band is better suited to do that. And if I do it, it seems a little creepy, if you will. I don't know, Adam, do you have a perspective on that?
Well, I mean, is as far as posting on Punk News in particular, or just you know, in general, just sort of the overall amount of stuff that you're outputting on the internet?
Precisely.
I think we're in a position where, because we're kind of on the other side of the fence with the music journalist stuff, and we're more aware of what we're able to post and what we're not able to post about, we forget that a lot of the bands that we talk about, there isn't really a lot of other people talking about them, at least not talking about them in a way that's not incredibly brief and then lost into the morass of everything else that's going on online. And one of the nice things about Punk News, or even outside of Punk News, just like whatever else right now, is that if you have one of these things that you are, you know, a genuine big fan of, you can take the initiative and get that out there and make that heard. And I don't think you should shy away from having to do that, because, you know, there's at least as far as Punk News goes, there's no one telling you not to. And if you're not, who is? Like, I think that's part of it, is that there's probably a lot of bands that I, you know, that I'm into now because at some point someone decided to spend their time writing about them instead of, you know, sitting around watching Seinfeld reruns. So, you know, the efforts that we like voluntarily put into, I don't know, like appreciating and promoting this music that we like, that we don't think is being properly appreciated and promoted, is it bears dividends in weird places. So I'm all for it. Go ahead. I'm not stopping you.
You have given me something to ponder. So like I said, this is sad. Appreciate your family, appreciate your friends while they're still around to you know, appreciate it or understand, whatever. You get what I'm saying? So anyways, listen, I'm going to play a song. This is the last song on the last album by Mischief Brew. It's also the last song that they played on any on a radio session. So we're going to play the radio session version, but there's also an album version from This Is Not For Children. And then we'll come back and I guess we'll start the podcast regular. So once again, this is Mischief Brew. We'll be doing a bigger special later. But I thought this was, I guess, a fitting way to cap this discussion, at least. So this is Mischief Brew.
Was fired out from a cannon. The neighbors shot up at the lamps. We piled in the street and stood for our anthems. On top of the cars with bottles in hand. This year crept up, who could see it coming? No one saw the signs, if any were there. The distant funeral marches drumming. I'll take life, don't care if it's fair. Read too many tales with terrible endings. Gods and machines that get in the way. Thought we were home, turns out we were renting. Until I am gone, I'm here to stay. Taking away our friends, our lovers. By cancer, heroin, tragedy. It's not the wakes I'm worried over. It's knowing we have to go to sleep. If it's a highway, I am trying just to drive. I am trying just to drive. Stay awake and stay alive. If it's a highway, I want you there. at the side. I want you there at the side, still awake and still alive. The songs we thought we'd have to bury, we faced them head on right away. Every reason to cry, not one to worry. Drive faster and further is my only change. So tattoo our arms and raise our glasses. Call out your names this New Year's Eve. And may the next time we kneel at a casket, we say at least the story's complete. If it's a highway, I am trying just to drive. I am trying just to drive. Stay awake and stay alive. If it's a highway, I want you there at the side. I want you there at the side. Still awake and still alive. If it's a highway, I am trying just to drive. I am trying just to drive. Stay awake and stay alive. If it's a highway, I want you there at the side. I want you there at the side. Still awake and still alive.
And we're back. There's no way to delicately move on from that. So RIP Eric Peterson, and the world goes on, and we will keep Eric Peterson in our thoughts, and we'll talk about him. But for right now, I guess we're going to talk about Against Me. Against Me has released a new album. It's called Shapeshift With Me. They put out a single. The single is called 333. The album's out September 16. Adam White, what did you think of the new Against Me track? And is it a significant departure from the last album, True Trans Soul Rebel? Is that the name of that album, True Trans Soul Rebel?
No. Transgender Dysphoria Boys.
Yeah, True Trans was the EP that came up before that, but it was also the chorus of the single from it. So easy mix up there. I'm excited for New Against Me. I think everybody's excited for New Against Me. They basically revitalized themselves on True Trans, and that on Transgender Dysphoria Blues. By embracing, you know, Laura's life changes and making that so central and overt in the band's messaging, plus just the fact that they had some lineup shifting between that, like that album is really the first of this new era. So this is going to be exciting. Oddly enough, I don't think at this moment 333 is all that interesting. And if for no other reason, it has not really grabbed me. I don't mind it at all. It's fine. It's good. It's a nice little song. But my mind isn't open. My face hasn't melted. You know, it's just fine. But I have a lot of faith in this, because some people I trust the opinion of very much who have heard this record have actually come and I've seen them online saying that, you know what, they say that this record is amazing. But this song is not really the best foot forward. So I'm gonna take that to heart, and yeah, and I am really looking forward to hearing this. And I mean, I don't wanna shit on this. 333 is cool. It's just not, you know, it's not blowing my mind.
When I listened to this the first time, I'm like, oh no, did they go back to the White Crosses era kind of thing? And then I gave it, and that was after just one listen. Then I gave this song a few more listens, and then I'm like, you can, the way Laura sings the lyrics with like the non-rhyming but with a bunch of words in one line, like just cramming them all into one line, kind of thing that she used to do back way back in the day, was very reminiscent of old Against Me. So overall, I'm cool with this one. I was thrown off by I'm just hoping for more powerful songs in this one. This one's very, for Against Me, this is very kind of middle of the road, big, you know, soaring vocals in the choruses and stuff like that. That's always good. Overall, I'm excited though. I pre-ordered this album because I'm
this feels like it feels like track five on a record. I mean, maybe that's what it is, but like it's track six, right?
It's
like
track
it's you don't lead off with it necessarily. It's not start and side two. It's fine, and I think within the context of the record, it'll be fine. I have the distinct impression that there is some crazy shit on this record, and they're keeping their powder dry and not really revealing that yet.
Yeah, I mean, I was hoping that when I first saw that they had released the single, that it was going to make a bigger, like a kind of a bigger splash, you know. I'm sure, like, if we listen to all these, I would probably go back and wonder why they made this the first song they released.
And I feel like they've done that several times. Like, there's a little bit of a habitual...
Maybe, like, they try and underwhelm people first, and then just go big. You know,
some bands aren't necessarily the ones who should pick their singles, right? There's a lot of times where you hear these stories about record labels that'll go, and they'll grab some random song that the band has, you know, thinks is just fodder, and they're like, no, this is the single, and then, you know, turns out that's the hit, so...
See, like, I think for the last album, was it Black Me Out that was the first single that they released? And that was, like, that's the last song on the album.
I don't know, but I...
And that's a great song and everything, but why, I just, like, I think even back then, I wasn't sure why they led off with that one.
Yeah, I mean, I would be very superstitious about that if I were them, if only because, like, to me, like, last song on a record is a big deal. I don't want to really know... First time going in, what that is, but yeah. Anyways, I don't know.
Just real quick, the one of the commenters on the story said like they played a few songs recently at a show, and that this commenter was at, and they said like this is they're oh god, what did he say? Sorry, I'm looking for the they played this song along with Crash and Boyfriend at the Milwaukee show. This is what the commenter said. They played this song along with Crash and Boyfriend at the Milwaukee show, and this was the weakest of the three. I'm looking forward to the album. So I think this happened again. They came out with a mid-range song that's good, but is it their best on the album? I mean, chances are no. But I don't think it's not a bad song. It's good. I did enjoy it after a few listens.
The cover art to this record is totally hot, and I love it. There's something about that color scheme is just super punk rock to me, and I really like that art. It's cool. Contrast that to the cover art on the new NoFX record, and there's a night and day difference there. But we'll talk about that one in a minute.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I pre-ordered this. The pre-order was a little steep, price-wise, but overall, this is definitely going to be worth it. I have a lot of faith.
Shipping for a record is $4. They were charging $8 shipping on a record.
It was like $25 for just the album, which I have faith in because you know, Laura and the band are sort of vinyl nerds. You can kind of see like through tweets sometimes they'll talk about stuff, and I'm wondering if the record is will be like 180 gram vinyl, which is obviously more expensive. You know, they also like to do big gatefold covers also, so usually we get a lot from this band.
You Americans are adorable with your pricing. Like $8, $4 to ship in. Okay, first of all,
it wasn't four. It was eight.
If I'm in Canada and I can order a record that and I can get it for $25, including shipping, I have fucking robbed the bank. That does not happen. Oh my god. For me to, this is why I don't mail order records here. I'm going to go look up something random right now and just tell you how fucking expensive it'll be. All right.
Well, well, listen, Adam, $4 shipping, $15 records. That's the delicious taste of freedom.
I guess that's the taste of freedom. What's going on this week in Cleveland, John?
They're just mad because they can't, because they had to spend $25 in the next against me record. That's why. Well,
speaking of Cleveland, I need to correct myself from last week just really quick while Adam looks this up. I made the mistake of thinking, I thought November 8th was like that against me show I'm going to was on the election. It's not. I thought that was that date of the show was a Tuesday. It's not. So it turns out Election Day is November 8th. So, just wanted to get that out of the way.
Failed your civics class.
Go vote, you know, do that.
Whenever, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Whatever day you want to show up.
Exactly.
Who gives a shit? All right. Here, I'm going to do something here. Add to cart. Go to cart.
Adam's buying stuff.
I'm buying stuff too. Okay.
Adam, do you not have media mail in Canada?
Nope, that's not a thing.
I think we went over that, didn't we? One time? Media mail rules.
I'm just rubbing it in.
Yeah. No, everything is horribly expensive. So let's see. Okay.
Why is stuff so expensive in Canada, Adam?
There's a whole bunch of economic reasons. So, all right. So if I wanted to... So here we go. If I went to, and I'm by no means criticizing this label because this is just normal in Canada. If I go onto Dine Alone Records website and I want to buy
a Canadian label though,
they're a Canadian label, right?
Okay.
So and I want to go buy a copy of the Dirty Nails Higher Power, just the normal, like no pre-order shit, just the standard, you know, black vinyl version of this. So if I go there, all right, so the record itself is all Canadian, $18 for the LP. Then, okay, I want to ship to Canada and Ontario. So I'm basically shipping from Toronto to Niagara Falls, which is about an hour and, I don't know, an hour and 20 minutes on a good day drive, say. Now, I have three shipping options available for this. I could go pick it up in Toronto at no charge. Now, that's a special thing that they do. If I have them send it to me using regular Canada Post, so Canada Post is like the Canadian USPS, I guess, right? Just like regular, put it in the mail and send it to me. Shipping is $13.
Whoa!
Them to express post it to me, which is, you know, I get it in a couple days, it would be $17. So, like, there's no way that I'm getting that record from this label for under $31. And this is a Canadian label, and I'm not shipping over the border or anything like that. If I had to go buy a record from a fucking U.S., like, I don't know, let's go to...
I just like to put this into perspective, though. You're talking about Canadian, 31 Canadian dollars, right? Because 31 Canadian dollars right now, and I converted this because I'm a nerd, is 23 and a half American.
Yeah, in Canada, it's still $31. That's crazy. So that doesn't matter.
No, but it does matter. I mean, Adam, what's the minimum wage in Canada?
I don't know, actually.
Listen, people, Adam's crying about his bank account.
$11.25.
He doesn't know what minimum wage is.
$11.25.
The minimum wage in the U.S. is like 8 or 7.
Yeah, but here in it depends on the state. And here in California, I think it's closing in on 10 or a little.
There's federal minimum wage and state minimum wage.
Right.
Federal minimum wage is like $7.25 or something.
Yeah.
When I was working, it was $4.
So, yeah. So, anyways, I find your complaints about having to spend an extra $4 adorable.
Like, Adam, if you go buy a coffee at Tim Hortons, what's a coffee cost?
Let's see. What size? And we have to convert the size into Canadian, of course.
Normal size. Normal. I'm not a glutton, but I'm not. I don't want a tiny drink either. Normal size.
A normal size. So like, so to me, 12 like
ounces. However, milliliters that is.
All right, hold on. Because we have the stereotype in Canada about Like an American medium of a drink being like, you know, so large it would be illegal to sell in Canada because you're all gluttons. So let's see here.
Gluttons with cheap records, baby.
Cheap records, heart disease, and whatever's going on in Cleveland. Yeah. All right, hold on here. Let's see. Can I get pricing? I want legit coffee pricing right now.
If you buy a can of Coke from the machine, what's that cost?
I don't know, John. I don't buy a can of Coke from
a machine. You go outside of your house, Adam?
I do. I actually, no, you know what? My problem is that I use a card for everything. So when I'm like buying a coffee, it's like, put it on the card. And then I have no fucking idea what it is. Boom, boom, boom. Hold on here. I'm just going to look on this random internet thing. So this random internet thing, when I type Tim Hortons pricing, because I don't know it off the top of my head, is telling me that a large coffee is $1.99, but I don't know if that's true.
In the U.S., a large coffee is like $1.19. So our prices are almost the same, Adam.
Shut up, John. I'm making fun of you. I don't know if this is true. Point is, it's expensive to get records shipped around or purchased in Canada, and I hate you all. This is where I was going with that. Ricky, tell me about Little Bags.
Okay, Little Bags. The pop punk quartet side projects, band before Pairs of, which consisted of Zach Quinn, Brian Paredes, and Eric Goodyear, who are now in Pairs with drummer Matthew Bracken, have announced that their self-titled album will be released through New Orleans-based Community Records on July 29th. You can find the link to the pre-order for the limited run cassette from the label, and you can take a look at some of the songs to their Bandcamp on the other link. Did you give either of these songs a listen, Adam? Because I actually pre-ordered this, and I can talk about it too, but I wanted to hear what you guys thought.
Yeah, so is this a pre-Pairs band? Or
this is a pre-Pairs band.
So was this all recorded before Pairs happened, or is they doing this as like a side project?
No, I don't know if they officially broke up. I don't know, but I know that this was done before Pairs.
And do we know when?
You know, I don't.
So what I'm getting at is that I don't mind these two tracks. It's definitely like of a bit of a, like a lower key than some of the loud crazy stuff that Pairs has put out. It feels a little throwback to some like early, there's some like early 2000s emo kind of influence that's shining through in some of this. I don't mean that in a bad way. But that makes me wonder, is like, was this something they did like, was it just like last year they recorded this stuff, or was it like three or 4 years ago?
No, this was before Go to Prison came out.
Yeah, so like, I mean, way so, before. Yeah, so there's some, I can feel like there's some earlier in the 2000s vibes that I get through some of this stuff, but it's neat. It's an interesting counterpoint to how, you know, how shouty, let's say, some of the Pairs stuff is to hear these guys doing this stuff. I don't mind it. I don't mind it.
John?
Yeah, like Adam was saying, it's kind of like mid-tempo, alt-rock, emo-ish kind of thing. Not my bag, but it is interesting how strikingly different Pairs is. And it says to me, was Pairs organic, or did the band say, all right, we need to make a cool band, here's what we're going to do to make a cool band? That's why this is interesting to me.
I think it was organic. I actually pre-ordered this, and I just got an email with the free album, with the free digital version. I'm like halfway through it. You guys pretty much hit it on the head. It's for those listening though, this is very different from what they do now. It's mellower, and I need to finish, and I'll probably, and once the album officially comes out, maybe I'll play a song on the podcast at some point. But overall, I think this was cool. I think it's a very cool, if you're a Pairs fan, you'll probably be pretty fascinated by the contrast with this band.
It's cool. It's neat. It's neat to hear something like that from a band that, you know, you've been so into, especially you, you've been so into their new stuff to go back and to try to dig into what these guys were thinking before that is super interesting. John, I think we get to some of the other music related stuff this week, we're going to talk about a few, a couple Apple things. Your buddies, particularly in your good graces right now, because they won't fix your 600-year-old laptop or whatever is broken.
Yeah, 5.5 years, Adam, is not old for a laptop.
John, I have burnt through 3 laptops in 5.5 years, and I was glad to do it. That's what happens. I
have a washing machine that's 35 years old, Adam.
Oh, John. Anyways, Apple, we all know how big a fan you are of Steve Jobs. There's a couple stories that came out this week. One of them is, or not this week, I guess over the past few weeks. The one of them I just want to touch on right now. I don't really want to, I don't know if it needs commentary because it just, it's bugging me how bewildering this is. And it speaks, I think, to how the left hand of one of these companies doesn't know what the right hand is doing. So there was all this controversy. I don't know if everyone remembers this, a few weeks ago, in which someone claims that Apple Music via the iTunes app had deleted their music library or something like that. And they claimed that they had all of these, incredibly rare tracks and, homemade recordings and things like that, that were deleted and never to be recovered. And it was a huge controversy and it blew up. And there was like 24 hours where, it seemed to be like a colossal blunder. And then it got a little bit more murky because all the tech people that actually started looking into it were saying that, like, well, hold on a minute. The only person that this would have deleted their library is if the person went in and deleted their library. There was no really way for this to happen otherwise. And it got a little bit fuzzy, but it was part of this general commentary you've heard since Apple Music's come out, that the way that it matches songs and figures out what audio track things are isn't really great. And we've even talked about this before where we've said, you go to play a version of a song, and then when you go to play that song, you actually get the censored version, or you get a slightly different version that has the same name. Well, it turns out Apple has gone and they've changed the algorithm that they're using to do that. They were using a metadata match to do it, which means they were looking at the name of the song and all the ID3 stuff that was on the MP3 file, basically. And they were matching that up to a database. So if you had a song that was called, Olay by the Bouncing Souls, and they would go and they would pull the one out of their database that was listed under Olay by the Bouncing Souls and give that back to you. And maybe that wasn't actually the same track. But what they're going to do now is they're going to start audio fingerprinting to make that match, which actually makes sense. And that seems fine. It seems like they're going from a basic way of doing this to a smart way of doing this. But the part that's driving me crazy is that they already had that. Because I don't know if you guys were ever subscribers to this service, but there was this thing that Apple had a few years ago before Apple Music came out called iTunes Match. And what it would do is it would take copies of your songs from your library, even songs that were not part of the Apple libraries or anything like that, and it would upload them to an Apple server somewhere. And then wherever you were on any of your devices, you could pull down that song. So for the longest time, that was what I used to say, listen to, like tracks by the Dirty Nail back when they were never on any of these online services. Cause I had the MP3s, they were in my library. And then if I was on my phone somewhere, I could just say, play that song by the Dirty Nail. And it would go, oh, okay. I already synchronized that one up from your computer. So I'll play that for you.
Isn't that copyright infringement?
No, not really in that case. They're...
Why not? I mean, look at it this way. Well, I mean, I can't speak to Canadian law, but the U.S. law, you're not allowed to distribute a copyrighted material. So if you have an MP3 on your computer and they upload it to their database, so you play it on another device, in the U.S., that's clearly copyright infringement.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. All right. So I think that maybe by the letter of the law, you could make that argument. When this came out, though, one of the reasons why this was supported, if I recall back to when iTunes Match came out, was it was giving all of these people that had these like vast MP3 libraries a way to, in a way, legitimize that library by going and saying that, like, okay, here I'm taking all of this material that I have and I'm pushing it up into the ecosystem. So I'm sure there's some sort of record label, song tracking and royalty stuff that's happening on that level that wasn't before. There was some weird compromise to it. But regardless, they had the technology to look at the song on your computer, do an audio fingerprint of the song, and then decide if that song needed to be uploaded or not. So with iTunes Match, I could take a version of the Bouncing Souls Olé, 3 minutes into the song, dub myself in, sing in the chorus, and then stick it in my library. And then if I went and pulled that song up on my phone later, I would get my version of the song. I wouldn't get the Bouncing Souls version of the song because it was fingerprinted. It wasn't just matching the name of the song. So Apple had that technology 3 years ago, but that's not the way that Apple Music has worked. And then they had all these problems. And then I guess they were like, oh, hey, let's put the technology we have that works in a more intelligent way. Let's go slot that in instead of the dumb way that we were doing this. I'm sure there was a million engineering things behind the scenes why that didn't happen. But it's just one of those things where it boggles my mind why they wouldn't have done that from the start. And it's just sort of indicative of the whole weird Apple Music shit show, and that there's so many things in there that are like sort of good ideas, but it feels like they needed like another year to get it all ironed out. But instead, they rushed it out, and I don't know. There's just been weird shit like that since.
Yeah, I've been noticing that whole rushing shit out a lot lately, especially since and really it's. I know we like to take shots at Steve Jobs, but that's really been a characteristic of how. Tim Cook has been running the company, I think.
I feel that if Jobs was around and he walked into the room and the thing wasn't quite working right, he would have executed everybody in the room and thrown their bodies into a pyre in the middle of the Apple building.
Making the new people watch.
And made the new people watch, right?
Yeah. There've been plenty of screw-ups, weird purchases made by the company under Tim Cook, and it's definitely not the same Apple overall. And then
I'm loving it like the ancient pharaohs, when one dynasty would take over after the previous dynasty, they would smash out the name of the previous pharaohs. I'm loving it.
Well, I don't think they're producing as well as when Steve Jobs was in charge.
It's weird, and I'm pretty much one of these people that's going to be like a lifetime Apple user, just because everything else that I use is just a different degree of shit. So I feel that like things aren't as maybe necessarily rosy as they once were, but there's a little bit of, I'm going to use rose twice in a sentence, is horrible, but there's a little bit of rose-colored glasses going on even with the Jobs era, because from a web application standpoint, Apple's never been that great at it. Like, their hardware has always been way more solid than some of the software stuff that they put out, especially some of the online software stuff. So that's always sort of been the case, and it's super super obvious with the Apple Music thing. But anyways, I don't know. I just wanted to comment on that. It's just a bewildering... I don't know. I'd love to know the engineering rationale behind the end. I'm sure this is super interesting to all the punk rock people, but anyways, that was a thing.
I actually think I have a good guess as to why that all happened.
Why, John?
Because engineers are not music people, and so engineers would not necessarily realize that that would be important to music or artist fans. It just wouldn't even occur to them. You know what I mean? So they're seeing it from a strictly data standpoint, whereas they don't understand how that would, they wouldn't even necessarily conceive that there might be different versions of the same song. They don't even, of course they're aware that condition exists, but that's not something that would occur to them while designing the program.
Yeah, and I think you're probably right, because you think about something where you like, oh, I like this version of I like this version of Raw Power better because it's a different master, right?
Oh,
well,
it is.
Well, right, like where the song from a metadata standpoint is otherwise going to be exactly the same, right? It's going to have the same title, same artist, same album, same year it was released, even. All that's going to be the same. Sure, there's different information about, say, like who mastered it and when, but generally we're not tagging our MP3 files with information that's that detailed. So yeah, that's a good example of that. But John,
Adam, let me supplement my point with the case of MP3s. MP3s, it's a 128 bit rate. Is that what it's called, Adam, or something?
That is a bit rate. That's one of them.
Like, what fidelity are MP3s at? Is it 128 something?
They can be at multiple. Most of the ones that you would get off of a service at this point are done in something called VBR at this point, which is a variable bit rate, which will up or down the rate sort of based on the audio information that has to be in the song. Generally, if you ask me, back in the day when I was ripping a lot of MP3s, I would usually rip things at either at probably like, I think 192 was sort of my threshold for, like, you know, you could go more than that, but I didn't have that much hard drive. So, you know, 128 sounded like ass, and I don't know.
Well, the point being is, my friend Sean went to Carnegie Mellon. One of his professors was one of the main guys that invented the MP3. And they selected, I think it was 128, because they figured most people wouldn't care about sound quality beyond 128. And that just goes to show why engineers don't know much about music or art. Because famously, people hated MP3s because they sounded so bad. So, I mean, that just goes to prove, or just to not prove, but to show that engineers are not great with music and art and that kind of a thing, because they thought 128 was fine, while music fans hate 128.
Yeah. So that's, there's so much that, like, gets wrapped up in this weird sort of intersection of technology and art that we're having to live through right now, that I don't know. It's a super interesting topic to me. But John, that is not why you wrote Apple in our show schedule this week. You wanted to talk about the camera thing.
Yeah, well, here, Apple's got a new, I guess it's probably software and hardware, or just software.
It's a patent. So it's a drawing on a piece of paper.
Yeah, but that could be software or hardware.
It's a combination of both, I'm sure.
It could be both.
It would have to be both. It would probably have to be both. Yeah.
I think the patent showed both.
Anyways, Apple's got some device. It's a patent. They haven't actually made it. Well, actually, they probably have made it, or maybe they haven't. Regardless, they've got a patent for a device that basically, if you're filming something with your iPhone, not necessarily all phones, but with your iPhone, is the device shoots out, you know, infrared rays and basically ruins your phone, so your camera cannot take pictures. And so the reason the music community picked this up, they're like, hooray, hooray, all these annoying people with the phones out at the show, they'll be able to put up these little beam shooter things, and people stop doing it because it'll ruin their video, so people won't hold up their cameras at shows anymore, and you can enjoy the show. However, there's a quite more nefarious use, or is it a nefarious use? I'm on the fence. I really don't know where to stand on this, and here's why. The music part of this is actually incidental. Apple did not create this device to make punk rock shows more enjoyable for you. The main purpose of this device is so you cannot film things with your iPhone in certain areas. Methinks Apple specifically might have developed it for their own facilities to fight against industrial espionage, but that's just a guess. However, other uses for this are in public areas, with the police, in other areas. Like, what if the police, or here's another example, what if terrorists, or what if just your common criminals gets a hold of these devices and starts doing bad things, the police or bad people start doing bad things, and you can't film it because they got this device, and therefore you lose that evidence or that proof or however you want to put it. However, so you say, well, this device is an evil thing because it enables, you know, large corporations or whoever to basically further protect themselves and make it easier for them to do bad things. However, the contrast is, and my position previously was, we have willingly waltzed into the Big Brother state where we broadcast everything we do, and everything we do is filmed. So you could interpret this device as fighting against Big Brother and blocking invasion of your own privacy. So I honestly don't know where to stand on this. Is this a good thing in that it fights against Big Brother and the invasion of privacy all around? Or is it a bad thing in that it lets bad people do bad things and it's harder to get evidence against them? I don't know where to stand, Adam. I don't know where to stand.
I think you need to kind of think about who's going to be using it and when. I mean, when it comes to concerts, which originally, I guess this is what originally was for, you know, there was and is sort of a pretty good, like, underground, I don't want to say a movement, but like an attitude, like, of getting people to just enjoy the show and just put your phone away, which I think kind of caught a little bit of fire, I guess, a little bit. But I know I'm split on this one too. I'm pretty much where you are, John. Because I just see, like, so much potential abuse with this. unless it's really just for concerts, but still, like that seems so.
Well, what does that mean though? Just for concerts, right? Like if they have a technology that can broadcast out and disable the recording devices that a bunch of people have, yeah, you know, I guess they could. I mean, think about it in that. Okay, let's say it's only for concerts. So some scumbag that runs like the weird auditorium in town is able to go buy one, but the cops aren't.
I know. So it really, it sort of just, I guess it just depends on who's using it.
Yeah. So there's a Black Lives Matter protest. Let's turn off everyone's phones. Right. That kind of thing seems, you know, super sketchy, which is why I'm sure this is something that's never actually going to come into production. And the thing
they were pretty sure that Trump wasn't actually going to run for president, Adam.
Well, here's the thing about software patents. A lot of the times you go and you register, and this is especially software patents in the U.S. because you can register patents in the U.S. without much of a actual proof that you have this thing. Like, you can go register the idea and then use that as a legal hammer to try to sue people once someone else implements something that is close to the idea. It's really a huge problem with your patent system. But it can also be used by...
You have patent rolls in Canada?
Not to the degree you guys do. Not at all. The patent troll thing is really a uniquely American problem, and it's because you can go get a patent on something in the States with very little proof that you actually have the thing, or you can take it to market or anything like that. You can still get patents in Canada, of course, but I think there's more of a burden of proof to show that you actually have a thing. Like, I couldn't walk in there tomorrow and patent like time traveling bananas because that's an idea I just came up with. I'd probably have to have some sort of something more substantive.
In the U.S., you have to prove that it's functional, that it could exist, that it could work.
But you've seen what's been happening. There's a lot of people that are patenting, you know, sketches on the back of a napkin, and then they come back in 15 years and find someone that's done something close to that and try to sue the pants off of them. There was something actually about Apple not too long ago where some wacko came out of the woodwork because he had drawn something that kind of looked like an iPhone with a hinge in the middle of it back in the 80s. And he was like, look, that's an iPhone right there. I should claw some money out of the Apple empire. And I don't know, that happens all the time. But what Apple could be doing is patenting this kind of thing specifically to sit on it, which is something that companies do sometimes. I don't know. It seems so problem prone that I can't imagine it's going to get out there into real life. Or if it does, it's the kind of thing that people are immediately going to figure out how to hack. So, jailbreak your phone to turn off the creepy recording thing or whatever. I mean, Ricky, you touched on something though that I think is my hope. And that is that just socially we're going to figure out that it's kind of an asshole thing to have your phone up in the middle of a concert, and it's going to become less of a problem. And
as an example, like for me, if I want to get a picture, like I'll post, you know, I always post pictures on the Punkin's Instagram at a show. What I do is I give myself the first song to get the right picture, and then that's it. Then I just put my phone away, and then in between bands, I'll check everything. But then after that, I just put it away.
Yeah, and I mean I'm becoming more and more conscious of this the more that I see people that are totally soaked into their phones.
Oh yeah,
and it's starting to really bother. Like, I feel incredibly self-conscious at this point when I actually have it. I've always had this when, say, like me and my wife are at dinner, and for whatever reason, one or the other of us is pulling out their phone. I don't mean at dinner at like a restaurant with white tablecloths. I mean, like, we're sitting in a, you know, we'd be sitting in a Tim Hortons having a coffee or something like that, right? If one of us is looking at our phone for some reason, so like let's say my wife is looking at her phone, I won't touch mine, and vice versa. If I have mine and she'll pull hers out for some reason, I'll put mine away. I've so often will look and see like two people sitting across from each other, and both of them staring at their phones, and I'm just like, fucking God, I don't want to be that.
Believe it or not, I've actually seen it worse. And you're a parent, so maybe this will hit a little bit more home with you than it did with me. But you know, I've been to restaurants, you know, where like they'll have their like 1 year old, both parents will be on their phones, and then they'll stick an iPad in front of their kid to watch some show.
Yeah, and we've been sitting next to we've been with our kid at a restaurant, sitting next to couples where like the couple will come in, they'll bring their two kids, each kid gets an iPad, and the two parents are looking at their phones. And on the one hand, their kids are quiet, and my kid is trying to like unscrew the legs of the stool that she was sitting on, right? But On the one hand, I can play holier than thou and be like, you know, oh, those people are idiots. On the other hand, you know, when both my kids are old enough to be unscrewing the things, maybe I'm just going to capitulate and like give them some iPads and shut them up. But but I mean, yeah, I'm super self-conscious of it, and I'm actually more self-conscious of it in the past few weeks because of this Pokemon thing, where we're just like I'm walking around and I look and there's like people just like wandering, staring at their screens. And then I'm like, all of a sudden I'm like, I may have pulled my phone out of my pocket and like, you know, went to look at, I don't know, CNN or something to see what was going on in Crazy Town. But, I'm not going to do that right now because I'm having this feeling that there's a little bit of like a, you know, that saying, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can be the one-eyed man, but I'm not going to pull my phone out right now, right? Where yeah. I'm going to be the only person in the room that is looking around and, you know, watching my six and keeping, you know, ready for anything. And then when shit goes down, I'm going to get out of there and everyone else is staring at their phone. I don't know what shit goes down means. I'm just... You know, the aliens are going to land. They're going to go, who's in charge? I'm going to be the one to put my hand up because everyone else is looking at Pokemons. That's what I think. Anyways, that's been your weird Apple podcast segment. John, let's talk about one more music thing and then we'll play a song.
Okay, yeah, listen, we'll just do briefly on this. We talked about this before, but I just wanted to bring this up. Katie Goodman and Greta Morgan, they're putting out an album called Take It, It's Yours. It's the two young women doing all covers of punk tunes, but they do the covers in sort of a, I don't know how you would describe it. I guess you would say singer-songwriter style. They put out a cover of Gun Club's Sex Beat track, and it's fantastic. It's wonderful. Like I said before, their two voices combine marvelously. Katie Goodman with the high-pitched voice, Greta Morgan with the low lounge singer voice. Ricky, man, do you dig this?
You know, I didn't, but I'm not gonna. I did. Yeah, it wasn't like a.
Shut up! Get off the podcast, Adam White. Wasn't this great?
Well, wait a minute. I didn't. It wasn't like offensive, but it was just. It was a little just mellow for. It was just too mellow for me. But I'm not. It wasn't horrible. I didn't think it was like terrible. I just didn't.
Not everything has to be drowning pool, Ricky.
I
threw him. That was
it
good.
Did throw me. It wasn't bad. It just didn't do anything for me.
This is wonderful. Don't listen to Ricky. This is a cool
don't
track.
Listen to me. Whatever.
Yeah, we'll just leave it at that. Don't listen to Ricky. No, Ricky, play a song. Let's keep going.
Okay, so one of our regular listeners, I don't think I should name names because I don't know if he wants me to or not. He's like, oh, you played NDK in a few episodes ago. You should try play No Cash. And I'm like, that's a great idea. So I finally got around to looking through No Cash's discography, found a song. For that listener, you know who you are. And this is No Cash's song called Skate or Die, not related to the Teenage Bottle Rocket song. And it is off. What?
Show some fucking respect here. Not related to the Planet Smashers.
Oh, Planet Smashers.
Thank you.
My bad.
Remember who came first.
Lots of Skater Dies. This is Skater Die by No Cash.
Show some respect. Not related to the Avril Lavigne song.
That was Skater Boy.
You know it.
Yeah, because I was like six when that came out. Anyway, so No Cash, Skate or Die, that's the name of the track, off Run Your Pockets. Here it is.
Thank you.
And we're back. And honestly, we're being a little hard on Ricky this week. Ricky, I'm sorry for being hard on you. I'm sorry for ragging on you. Ricky's a good guy. He loves Admiral.
It's been a tough week, man. It's okay.
It has been a tough week. Adam, what are we rocking along? Are we blowing through these last few stories? Let's do. Oh, we definitely should. Yeah, listen.
Yeah. Oh man, we got to talk about the. Yes, all three of these next stories we need to talk about.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. This one was highly contentious on the Punk News podcast. Prophets of Rage, which is Chuck D, which Ricky called Rome, which blew my mind. Dare called Chuck D Rome, but it's Chuck D, Be Real, and the other three guys from Rage Against the Machine that don't sing. They released a new song. The song is called Prophets of Rage. Mixed results on Punk News. Some people thought it was cool. Some people thought it was terrible. Ricky, I'll give you the first word. Did you like this song?
No, I didn't. And here's why. You know, the great thing about Rage, and we kind of talked about this when they released something like a live song a while back. The great thing about Rage was they brought punk rock and with just enough hip hop and mix it together and did that. And like, I think we're like the only band that ever did that well back in like the late 90s and early 2000s.
Beastie Boys, Ricky. Beastie
Boys too. But anyway, Rage Against the Machine did it really well. They were one of the few that did it really well.
Run DMC, Ricky. Run DMC.
Anyway, this song though, one, Limp I thought.
Ricky,
I,
Limp Bizkit.
No, I had. Now you need to leave the podcast.
Olympus is terrible. I'm just being funny. Go ahead, Ricky. I'm sorry.
So, this, you know, first of all, I'm not a fan of this. I felt was sort of the lyrics I thought were a little on the self-indulgent side. But this I thought was a little too hip hop and not enough anger and punk rock. So, I'm sorry. I'm still a Prophets of Rage skeptic at this point.
You want my vote on this?
Do it.
I do.
This is awful.
Okay, so look at that.
I think this is horrible. I think it is incredibly boring given the caliber of skill of the people that are involved in this band. This is not that interesting at all. It is one of these incredibly run-of-the-mill. There's no message. Is what I guess I want to say. It sounds like the track of not a band that was put together because they were all mutually outraged at what was going on in the American political world. It sounds like a dumb, calculated song that was part of like some, you know, major label band back in the 90s, you know. Yeah. You know, it sounds like the kind of song they would put together as they're trying to like make their name for themselves. I mean, what is the message of this song? The message of this song is the band is called Prophets of Rage and jump, 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 right? Like that's what I got, right? And if you compare it to any of, say, Rage Against the Machine's or Public Enemy's songs that were really, you know, that were big and they were making a statement, I would compare it to, say, like, I don't know, People of the Sun, right? So, which is the lead single off of Evil Empire. So, what was People of the Sun about? It was about something incredibly specific. It was about like the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, Mexico. So there was something incredibly narrow that Zach and the band had narrowed in on for that song. And because they were singing about something, to me, the song holds up and the message of the song holds up and the whole thing works. If you look back at like early Rage songs that don't really work anymore, you can look at something like, say, Killing in the Name Of, where... Well,
Killing in the Name has become a bit of a cliche.
Right, where if you look at it at this point, especially like the dumb radio edits of it that are out there, it just comes off as sloganeering, right? Like they're not saying anything except for, you know, like outrage, right?
That was on their first album. That was an introduction to the band, which is why it was a good song. But this one, it's introducing stuff kind of vaguely.
Yeah, I mean, they don't need to do this. I guess what I'm getting at. Like, to me, like it should be enough. It should be. This could have been like, it should have been Chuck D, and then just like a bunch of homeless people that he found, and it would have had enough. You know, like enough artistic relevancy behind it that no one would really need to have some sort of an introduction to it at this level. He could have just went in and started making a statement and people would have listened to him because he was Chuck D. But instead there's like, there's this, and this is just so, awful. You know, it's just awful.
Not just message wise though. This I thought was not Tom Morello's best at all. You know, I mean, his guitar is usually a lot more interesting than this.
It is.
I thought it was way too repetitive, and it was. I thought it was. He was kind of phoning it in on this one.
What this band needs to do, the only thing that this band needs to do is they need to have to. They just need to prove why they need to exist, and it's one thing to. You know, if they were just going to put this band together and play protest shows at the RNC, then great. That's their justification. But they're actually going in. They're making studio recordings. They have a logo. They have, like, they're treating this like it is a real, you know, functioning business unit of a band. So, okay, at this point, like, why do you need to exist? What are you bringing to the table? And a single, which is, you know, We Are Prophets of Rage, Jump, 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 is not making that case to me.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. When I saw this, I was on the fence. I'm like, ugh, this could be good. This could be awful. And it just didn't do anything. It just kind of deflated.
Why is Public Enemies Bring the Noise such an iconic song, but this is not iconic whatsoever, even though they essentially have the same message?
It's got to be time and place, right?
Yeah, I think, and also, this probably. I mean, I'm not like that. Obviously, I'm not that well versed in hip hop. This has
Ricky, to. You keep saying that. You need to learn about hip hop, Ricky. I'm not being funny. I'm saying like it would be worth your time and worth your journalistic career and worth your own self.
I know.
To check out hip hop, and I'm just going to name hip hop albums that listeners should check out right now. Public Enemies, Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, Ice Cube's America's Most Wanted, MW's NWA's F the Police, Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique, Scarface, Mr. Scarface is Back, Beastie Boy, License to Ill, Run DMC, Tougher Than Leather, Nas's first album, Ghostface Killer, Fish Scale, I've got one left, The Coup, Pick a Bigger Weapon.
Okay, The Coup I do listen to on occasion, because I do love Boots Riley. But when it comes to the Public Enemy song you're talking about, does this not come off as somewhat derivative? Oh,
I forgot Boogie Down Productions. Oh, Boogie Down Productions, Edutainment. Yes, this is derivative. This is not a great song. I feel bad about this and on Be Real, but Be Real does not need to be there at all. What they should do is they should just, you know, just let Chuck D do his thing and put badass riffs behind it. But they don't do that, you know. And I guess to answer my own question is maybe because they're trying to do Bring the Noise Part 2, and because, you know, Bring the Noise was a bunch of young guys, you know, in the cultural spotlight, energized by what they were doing. And so while that came up organically, I know we're using that word a lot and it's a cliche, but whatever. This is them saying, oh, we did that before. Let's do that again to get the same result. But art never works that way. The last few Public Enemy records, not the last one, but the three ones before that have been fantastic, especially How Do You Sell Your Soul to Soulless Heroes, Soulless People That Sold Their Soul, which is a great album. Chuck D still has the lyrics and he still definitely has the boom bap in his voice. He just didn't bring his A game on this. He really didn't.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying also kind of backs up what I was saying, is that this is, I think this is just, there's too much hip hop involved in this for what a rock band should be. That's just my opinion.
What do you mean too much hip hop?
I think this was this, you know, like I was saying, like, you know, there's obviously punk rock and hard rock here. But then there's also the hip hop element, and
What do you mean specifically hip hop element?
Well, I mean, I think the beats, the feel, and the words they're more like saying and rapping the words than screaming like Zach used to do. And I think I'm just biased towards Rage Against the Machine, but I think there's too much hip hop influence for this band, and not enough punk rock.
I disagree. You mentioned hard rock, and for a lot of
almost no band can actually pull off quote hard rock well, and it always sinks a band. And I think, you know, Audioslave proved that is hard yes. rock with Rage does not mix. They need to stay away from the hard rock. They need the banging riffs and the hip hop. I disagree that there's too much quote hip hop element. I think Chuck D, if anybody, can, you know, beat Zach De La Roca, and actually Chuck D's beaten Zach De La Roca many times. But I agree in that they feel, you know, that they've got DJ Lord on the turntable. So instead of having that loose, wild feel Rage has, they are chained to the mechanical,
metronomic
time of the turntable. I love DJ Lord. DJ Lord's a great DJ. I've seen him like three times. But he doesn't fit in the context of a live band. I agree with you on that. I think Chuck D's rapping fits great. He just needs to bring his better lyrics.
I think, you know, that is a point I agree with. That's good.
All right. Anyways, let's move on from that. So yeah. So Prophets of Rage, it's awful. John.
So new story. This is kind of in counterpoint to the Against Me story. NoFX is putting out a new album, and they also put out a new single. The new album is going to be called First Stitch Effort. I don't love that title, but the first single was called 6 Years on Dope. I say it every time, and I'm going to say it again. I'm not a huge NoFX fan, but more and more I like them. I like this track, and I like this track because this track was very punk rock, 90 seconds, fast banger, not a whole lot of melody or harmony, more riff-based, and also it's about drugs, which is always usually pretty – about heroin, which is always pretty punk rock. Maybe a little too slick production for me, but that's just the fat style. I don't love that style. But I don't think it hurt the track. I thought this tune was cool, and you know, I mean, honestly, this would probably be the first NoFX release that I actually genuinely do look forward to, and I'm excited to hear. Adam, what your take on it? You've been a fan of NoFX longer than I have, I believe.
Yeah, and I mean, they've definitely had some. NoFX is incredibly inconsistent on a single album basis, like song to song, they're wildly inconsistent, where they'll have songs that are absolutely incredible, and then they'll be parked against songs that aren't necessarily bad, but just songs that are, I don't know if they're trying to be goofy but they deflate the thing for me. And I often don't get through a NoFX record with any, I never managed to make it through a NoFX record without having like a few moments where I'm just like, ugh, I gotta get through this. And thinking back to something like what was the record that Bottles on the Ground was on?
Coaster? Is that Coaster?
No. Way before that.
Long and Thanks for All the Shoes.
Oh my God, I can't remember what the name of this NoFX record is. Everyone's screaming at it. NoFX discography.
Never Trust a Hippie.
That was not an album. That was a
S&M Airways. Animal.
Pump Up the Volume. Okay, so I liked Pump Up the Volume a lot, and there are a lot of songs on there that I think are incredibly good punk rock songs. Dinosaurs Will Die was amazing on there. Balls to the Ground, I thought, was a great, you know, as like a pop punk song, was a great thing. But then you'd hit a song like, what was on there? My Vagina, right? Where, you know, on the one hand, I get what they're doing in that they're trying to be a little bit provocative by taking some of these songs. We're gonna write a song. They're gonna be like, we're gonna throw like, you know, any and all sexual taboos at you on this track. But it's when they do it, they also take the tempo down, and then you get more of a sense that this has become kind of like a jokey, bumbling song because we want you to hear the funny lyric in it. Where if they would play those kind of joke songs with the level of kind of speed and intensity of the political stuff, then I would not have a problem with it. I don't know. It takes me out of a lot of their records. But in general, that said, I always find five or six tracks on every NoFX record that I really love. This one is a fucking banger. This is such a good song. I am so into this. I was listening down to repeat earlier because it's short enough that you can do that. I love that they're approaching this by having Mike and Smelly trade off
Melvin.
No, isn't Eric Melvin not
Smelly's our drummer.
Smelly's our drummer. What the fuck am I talking about? Yeah. I like that Eric and Mike are trading lyrics like that. And he'll often do screaming parts on their songs, but for to bring him in like this, especially on the lead single, and have him be such a prominent part of it, it really makes me wonder, will the rest of this album have more of that kind of interplay in it? Like, are they trying something a little bit different than what they've done in the last handful? And that to me has piqued my interest more than anything. Like, I'm super interested to see it, like, to the degree to which they do that. Like, is Mike ceding a little bit of frontman status to Melvin or what? Or is it just a one off on the song? Even if it is just a one off on the song is great. I'm super into it. Earlier in the podcast, I was making fun of the cover art to this, and it's fine. It's just it's more Photoshoppy and produced than that really cool Against Me cover art. That's all I was trying to say on that. But I know a lot of people seem to have a problem with the title to this record. I don't really care. It's fine. When it comes to titles, and you want to look at a lot of
It's a very no effects album title.
And they've had some doozies. So in the general over of no effects album titles, it's not that bad. So
I hate puns in out. I hate puns in album titles. I hate it.
That's kind of their thing.
They've gone to that well a few times, right?
War on Errorism.
But then look at War on Errorism. I mean, this is a great
War on Errorism was a good album.
War on Errorism was a good album, and there's a lot on there that actually War on Errorism. I'm looking at the track listing right now. Was a pretty great album. Separation of Separation of Church and State rips, right?
Yes.
I could give or take Franco and American, but I kind of get what it was trying to do. But you know, we've got Two Jealous Agains is on there, which is like the best love song to old punk 7 inches that you'll ever hear. So you know, there's.
Adam, have you heard the sequel to that song? It's so moving.
The one about the divorce, right?
I've got one jealous again. That's so great. That really is that's what I like about NOFX is their music is so autobiographical.
Are you okay? Are you broken? Did your robot brain?
Their music is so autobiographical in that it's like. A lot of music is autobiographical, but NOFX, they're so plain and it's such an open page. It lets you, NOFX almost sells themselves as a soap opera, as a band, you know?
Yeah, I don't even know where I was going with that. So I'm a fan of this. Ricky, you're a fan of this, I take it.
I am. I was pleasantly surprised and also had it on repeat for a little bit. What I can say is, let's see, I saw them in April. With Mean Jeans and Direct Hit, and they played Oxymoronic, and to the point you were wondering about, Adam, I think I remember Fat Mike taking vocals the whole time on that one, I think, at least the lead. So maybe this is a one-off, but I did like that trade-off. I thought it was really good. I'm interested to see what they did with Sid and Nancy, seeing how that was a demo on that Record Store Day 7-inch that came out this year. Album art, it's okay. I would like someone to explain why they chose this.
I mean, out of curiosity. Honestly, like the photo that's on there doesn't matter to me really. Like it's evocative enough of whatever, but what bugs me is that it looks like it's got an Instagram filter on top of it, and then it looks like they just kind of like went into the photo editor and slapped their logo on there. And that's such a weird nitpick, though. I mean, like, I don't really care.
Another nitpick is I don't know understand how it relates to the title. Speaking of Instagram, though, you know. Right after this was released, like probably 20 minutes after, like Fat Mike posted the raw footage of him and Melvin mouthing the words to the song, and it turns out he was just using his iPhone and a selfie stick, which I thought was kind of funny. I posted that link to the thing in the comment that I made. But yeah, overall, I will be paying attention and seeing what the next songs they release will be for this album, because I'm excited. I'm genuinely excited about this album.
Yeah, I mean, it's really this one song is really good. One of the really interesting things that I've kind of come to realize too, seeing the way that like the Mike interacts with people online, is he for all of his I don't know, celebrity status, I guess, and that's a bad way to put it, but the he really cares what people think of the stuff that he puts out. And I remember I saw like a few days ago, like someone posted a review of the Mild in the Streets comp that they had put out, and he went and found the link and shared it, and he was like this made my day that they've here. Look, someone likes my new thing that I put out, and I'm like, wow. Yeah. I'm like, you never see Mr. Brett giving too much of a shit about what the rest of the world thinks about some of the stuff that he does sometimes, but Mike like wears it on his sleeve, and it's kind of charming.
Well, honestly, yeah, and he's actually done that to I think two of my reviews. He has tweeted himself, and also, you know, Fat in general, they in like the little news, like in rumors part of their website, they also post reviews of their latest releases too. So they, I think the whole the organization as a whole does, but Fat Mike definitely seems to. I know he tweeted. What did he tweet? I know he did a NoFX show that I wrote about like the very first time, my very first like review on the staff. And then, he tweeted my Pears Green Star review.
I wonder if that's because like Fat Mike has never really sold out in that, like, Mr. Brett claims that he likes everything that Epitaph puts out. I don't believe it, you know.
Me either.
But you get the impression that Fat Mike really likes everything that Fat puts out, so it's more personal to him. Whereas for Mr. Brett, or let's not even use Mr. Brett as an example, for Matador, you know, for sometimes it's clearly purely a business decision. You know, actually, well, Rise Records, sometimes it, like, they don't care if people like it or not. If it sells units, then they're happy. You know, I don't mean to be too jaded about that, but that's the truth. So, like there, or in Mr. Brett's case, when he puts out some of this Attila stuff or Falling in Reverse, he's like, well, it's not for me, but if the kids like it, that's great. And if it gets bad reviews, that doesn't matter because the kids are buying it, ergo they must like it, therefore it's a good record. Whereas Fat Mike seems to have a personal, emotional investment, not a financial investment in each record, and that's why he seems more affected and more personal for reviews and that kind of a thing.
Yeah, so anyways, that's, I guess we'll move on from there, but that was, you know, we're all rooting for this records, you know, so far good, you know, one.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, everybody seems to always be rooting for Fat Mike and NoFX and the Fat Records. I kind of like that, you know, and that, like, there's no one that ever says like, oh, I hope this fails. You know, people always seem to be rooting for NoFX and Fat. And I don't know why. I guess just because they're on, you know, I do know why, because they're honest and people really do appreciate honesty. Fat by me, they're honest. Is they don't put out bullshit. They put out stuff that, you know, they seem to like, and they seem to tell people what's really going on with the label, with the release, and why they're putting out releases. That's why. I think I could be wrong.
All right, we're gonna wrap this week up with one more sad story. Unfortunately, the continuing, I guess, this ongoing 2016 theme that seems to be, we're losing a lot of veteran musicians. So suicides. Alan Vega has passed away. He was born in 1938, died in 2016. Interesting fact that I heard the other day, Alan Vega is actually older than Bob Dylan. But, you know, we lump him so much in with the
punk scene, yeah.
With the punk scene, eh? That's crazy. Anyways, Vega was the vocalist of the influential proto-punk act Suicide. He died on the Saturday of last week. He was 78 years old. The news was actually first reported by Henry Rollins on his website, along with a statement from Vega's family. The statement reads, in part, "One of the greatest aspects of Alan Vega was his unflinching adherence to the demands of his art. After decades of constant output, the world seemed to catch up with Alan, and he was acknowledged as the groundbreaking creative individual he had been from the very start." You can find a link to the full statement over there on Punk News. Suicide, of course, widely loved in the punk world for their 1977 self-titled debut album. They've been playing for years before that, since the early 70s, but they hadn't really put anything out that was a full length. Everyone's seen this cover. It says "Suicide" written across the middle of it. There's blood dripping from the letters. There's a red star up in the middle of it. It's one of these classic pieces of just like punk visual art, let alone an incredibly artistically daring record that, you know, everyone has just kind of, you know, was just at the root of, I think, so many bands, so much stuff that came out in the post-punk era, references back to Suicide. You may want to know why, like, Henry Rollins was so kind of tuned into this and such a part of the story. Rollins has done a ton to help promote Vega's music and, you know, outside of Suicide in particular. I think one of the first releases, if not the first release for Rollins' label, which is, what was his label name? It was like three numbers.
Six. No, I know this. Last one is 61. 311-61.
Yeah, one of the first releases, if not the first release for that label, was
211-61.
211-61. Okay. Was an Alan Vega solo record that he had seen, like, you know, languishing in obscurity, and he wanted to take and, like, get back out there. And, like, Rollins has been
213-61.
213. Okay. So Rollins has been a huge fan and supporter and friend of Vega and his family for many years. So that's kind of why he was lumped into this. But
Course, he famously covered Suicide on the very first Rollins Band record, Hot Animal Machine. He covered Ghost Rider.
He did. And that's actually what we're going to play. So we're going to play Ghost Rider, which is the first song off of that self-titled Suicide record. Go spend some time. Listen to that whole thing. It's pretty wild and crazy and way ahead of its time for 1977. And if you compare it to kind of like the other punk music that was happening at that era, like totally on a different planet. So this is Suicide with Ghost Rider. And maybe we'll cap it off with this one. So, you know, thanks for listening. If anyone wants to email us, we're at podcast@punknews.org. Thanks to Greg for producing and, you know, for the bands and the labels and everything for letting us play music on here. So this is Ghost Rider by Suicide. I'll see you guys next week.
Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. He's looking so cute, sneaking round in a blue jumpsuit. Who's riding a motorcycle hero? Baby, he's a blazing away. Stars in the universe. Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. Baby, he's a screaming the truth. America's killing its youth. Baby, he's screaming away. America's killing its youth. America's killing its youth.